We figured we only need about 5 gallons of gasoline in addition to that already in the tank to make the round trip. To be on the safe side, we bought 2 5-gallon cans of gas from the taxi fleet operator in Alexandria, who always bootlegs some of his allotment. As rationing has increased during the last few years, so has petty corruption of every sort. I guess a lot of the large-scale graft in the government, which Watergate revealed a few years back, has finally filtered down to the man in the street. When people began realizing that the big-shot politicians were crooked, they were more inclined to try to cheat the system a little themselves. All the new rationing red tape has just exacerbated the tendency, as has the growing percentage of non-whites in every level of the bureaucracy. The organization has been one of the main critics of this corruption, but I can now see that it gives us an important advantage. If everyone obeyed the law and did everything by the book, it would be nearly impossible for an underground group to exist. Not only would we not be able to buy gasoline, but 1,000 other bureaucratic obstacles with which the system increasingly hems the lives of our fellow citizens would be insurmountable for us. As it is, a bribe to a local official here, or a few dollars under the counter to a clerk or secretary there, will allow us to get around many of the government regulations which would otherwise trip us up. The closer public morality in America approaches that of a banana republic, the easier it will be for us to operate. Of course, with everyone having his hand out for a bribe, we'll need plenty of money. Looking at it philosophically, one can't avoid the conclusion that it is corruption, not tyranny, which leads to the overthrow of governments. A strong and vigorous government, no matter how oppressive, usually need not fear revolution. But a corrupt, inefficient, decadent government, even a benevolent one, is always ripe for revolution. The system we are fighting is both corrupt and oppressive, and we should thank God for the corruption. The silence about us in the newspapers is worrisome. The Berman thing the other day wasn't connected to us, of course, and it was given only a paragraph in today's Post. Robberies of that sort, even where there is a killing involved, are so common these days that they merit no more attention than a traffic accident. But the fact that the government launched a massive roundup of known organization members last Wednesday, and that nearly all of us, more than 2,000 persons, have managed to slip through their fingers and drop out of sight? Why isn't that in the papers? The news media are collaborating closely with the political police, of course, but what is their strategy against us? There was one small Associated Press article on a back page of yesterday's paper mentioning the arrest of 9 racists in Chicago and 4 in Los Angeles on Wednesday. The article said that all 13 who were arrested were members of the same organization, evidently ours, but no further details were given. Curious. Are they keeping quiet about the failure of the roundup so as not to embarrass the government? That's not like them. Probably they're a little paranoid about the ease with which we evaded the roundup. They may have fears that some substantial portion of the public is in sympathy with us and is aiding us, and they don't want to say anything that will give encouragement to our sympathizers. We must be careful that this false appearance of business as usual doesn't mislead us into relaxing our vigilance. We can be sure that the political police are in a crash program to find us. It will be a relief when the network is established and we can once again receive regular reports from our informants as to just what the rascals are up to. Meanwhile, our security rests primarily in our changed appearances and identities. We've all changed our hairstyles and either dyed or bleached our hair. I've begun wearing new glasses with heavy frames instead of my old frameless ones, and Catherine has switched from her contact lenses to glasses. Henry has undergone the most radical transformation by shaving off his beard and mustache. And we all have pretty convincing fake driver's licenses, although they won't stand up if they are ever checked against state records. Whenever any of us has to do something like the robberies last week, Catherine can do a quick change job and temporarily give him a third identity. For that, she has wigs and plastic gimmicks which fit into the nostrils and inside the mouth and change the whole structure of a person's face, and even his voice. They're not comfortable, but they can be tolerated for a couple of hours at a time, just as I can do without my glasses for a while if necessary. Tomorrow will be a long, hard day. The next diary entry is dated September 21st, 1991. Every muscle in my body aches. Yesterday we spent 10 hours hiking, digging, and carrying loads of weapons through the woods. This evening we moved all our supplies from the old apartment to our new hideout. It was a little before noon yesterday when we reached the turnoff near Bellefonte and left the highway. We drove as close to our cache as we could, but the old mining road we had used 3 years earlier was blocked and impassable more than a mile short of the point where we intended to park. The bank above the road had collapsed, and it would have taken a bulldozer to clear the way. At this point, there is an interpolated note to the reader by the editor of the diaries. Throughout his diaries, Turner used so-called English units of measurement, which were still in common use in North America during the last years of the old era. For the reader not familiar with these units, a mile was 1.6 kilometers, a gallon was 3.8 liters, a foot was 3/10 of a meter, a yard was 0.91 meter, an inch was 2.5 centimeters, and a pound was the weight of 0.45 kilogram, approximately. The consequence was that we had nearly a 2 mile hike each way instead of less than half a mile, and it took 3 round trips to get everything to the car. We brought shovels, a rope, and a couple of large canvas mail sacks, courtesy of the U.S. Postal Service, but as it turned out, these tools were woefully inadequate for the task. Hiking from the car to our cache with our shovels on our shoulders was actually refreshing after the long drive up from Washington. The day was pleasantly cool, the autumn woods were beautiful, and the old dirt road, though heavily overgrown, provided easy walking most of the way. Even digging down to the top of the oil drum, actually a 50-gallon chemical drum with a removable lid, in which we had sealed our weapons, wasn't too bad. The ground was fairly soft, and it took us less than an hour to excavate a 5-foot-deep pit and tie our rope to the handles, which had been welded to the lid of the drum.